Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Welcome, everyone, to Rockin' Nation Podcast. This is an episode of Dive Guts. We are on season, four. Getting to the end of season four. I think we only have one more episode of season four. Episode 30, one, two. What are we on now? I'm your host, Sam Snelling. With me, as always, by way of Interstate 70, hanging out there in the fair city of Indianapolis, Matthew J. Harris. Matt, how are you?
I'm well, sir. Sort of happy that we get a great, great dosage of live streams from Augusta, Georgia, to watch all the 2 weeks of Peach Jam. Some people like the European Championships for soccer. I had a kind of just nascently in the background today, EYBL stuff. So that is kind of a happy place. It's a nice little perk in the middle of July to get to just like occasionally look over and be like, oh, BBE and Drive Nation are playing right now. Cool. I'll watch about 10 minutes of that.
Yeah. So episode 33 we're on, apparently. I meant to look that up before we started, but you know, we were talking about our topic for this podcast, which crazy enough, Matt, it is the off season. What are we going to talk about? Well, Missouri recruiting. My favorite topic, your favorite topic, by way of, I guess, the amount of traffic that we seem to get at the site whenever we put recruiting in the title, I would say most people's favorite topic. And something that I think people may have accused me of stirring the pot a little bit. This past weekend, I wrote not one, but two posts on recruiting, mainly because the first one, so I've been kind of planning on this already. But the main thing that I was planning on is basically kind of doing a breakdown of how we can actually figure out, you know, football recruiting success versus basketball recruiting success and how they can compare. Mainly because, you know, you hear like a lot of people talking about, oh, like, you know, Drink's killing it on the recruiting trail and all this kind of stuff. It's like, all right, well, let's figure out, you know, how comparable football, because football and basketball are nearly impossible to compare. You know, because the objective in football is so different. The miss rate in football players is so much higher. You're basically hoping that like a third to a half of each recruiting class are going to give you, you know, production. Whereas basketball, you need like 75% of those guys to actually have an impact. And the more that you miss in basketball, then obviously the more dire things are going to be. you know, and so kind of having that margin of error with like three or four players versus 25 players is quite a difference on its own. So kind of what I did is I basically just kind of went through, I didn't really look at like individuals. I just looked at like the ratings on 247 Sports. And I just sort of kind of wrote down like how many guys were rated within a range. You know, 247 Sports uses like, I guess, 1,000 as being their, you know, the highest that you can rate a kid, basically being a one, I think, 1.0000. Yep. And then 9,900, 9,800, all with a decimal point in front of it. And it's interesting, like, how quickly the ratings in football decrease. In basketball, they really don't. I don't know, did you look over? I thought I shared with you the sort of spreadsheet that I was kind of using to kind of build all that out.
I think you did. The one thing I think that's nice, I think it's easier to have a little bit more of a finite or a finer grain with basketball recruits, because simply put, there aren't as many of them that you have in the ratings. I think 247's like composite only goes out to, like, if you click and go through, it only goes up to about 250. It goes way, way further than that in football. And you'll notice that it gets really, really granular, like a thousandth of a decimal point in some cases between two prospects, and sometimes even like 0.05 between three. So it gets really, really fine in the composite in basketball compared to football.
And so 247 has been expanding the amount of players that they do grade out. Now, I think that those numbers tend to grow with more exposure. Because so for basically what I did is I looked at 2017 for both football and basketball, and then I looked at 2022 and 2021, because those are kind of like the two Eli Drinkwitz classes. But I thought 2017 would be since that was Konzo Martin's first year, I guess first official recruiting class, you know, what would be kind of a good barometer. So there were like 619 players that were graded by 247 Sports, and they were like, you know, 7,600 and up. But there isn't, there's not a whole lot of traction, I think, once you kind of get to the kids that are like 8,300 and down. Yeah. Whereas with football, like, I did not count all of the football players, because at one point, like, my web browser got so like overloaded with the amount of data that was on the screen. Like, I couldn't like really run.
Scroll.
Yeah, like, it was becoming a pain in the butt. I think, what was it, 3,041 players were graded 7,700 or above in 2017. That number was 2,718 were graded 7,400 or above in 2021. And we've only graded about 1,450 players in 2022. So I would expect by the time the 2022 class wraps up, that number is probably close to doubled.
Yeah. And you'll see sometimes in basketball, there'll be some late rankings. Like, forever, Caleb Brown had no rating. Like, that was one of those kind of confounding things we went through, you know, him committing last summer through an entire senior season all the way up through, I think, like, late May. It wasn't until late May that 247 gave Caleb Brown a ranking. I think he wound up at, like, the equivalent, if you, like, multiply his decimal rating by 100, like an 82 out of 100, and he was number 322 in the composite. So forever, like, Caleb just was not rated. And then he was. And I think the hard part is, in this particular cycle, and we can talk about this, is because last year was basically like, could you watch every live stream and, like, rate guys? That was hard. And were those teams that were on live streams giving you accurate rosters? Like, I remember almost every recruiting reporter at some point last May and June being like, guys, please, like, at the top of your team's Twitter page, post your accurate roster so we know who's playing. Like, there are jersey numbers were not readable. Like, it's been a really tough scouting environment for both sports during this entire, you know, during this entire pandemic. And so once, you know, staffs have been able to get out on the road in June, and once we've had, you know, recruiting writers out, it feels like a lot of them are playing catch up and just trying to get guys into the ratings, trying to figure out where they are. And, you know, I think you and I have talked in the past that the 2021 and 22 classes are just going to be weird because there hasn't been a prototypical scouting cycle for them. And like, while sometimes scouts can like text with assistants and kind of like get feedback and try and adjust and gather intel and try and factor all that in, it's just been such a disrupted environment that I think you're going to see, you know, wide swings in ratings. Like Chandler Jackson jumped 50 plus spots in May, but that was the first time like really, you know, the majority of the scouting community was sort of able to get out and get eyes on him with Team Thad. And so I think you're going to see that to a certain degree, maybe not as wild a swing or a jump as that, but I think you're going to see that sort of happen as we move through July and maybe into the prep season a little bit. There's going to be some adjustments and some rating and guys going into the ratings at last because people have finally watched enough of them to feel like they can assess a grade on them.
Yeah, and kind of in regards to, I guess, some of the pushback on Christian Jones and his commitment, you know, from some of the unhappier segments of the fan base. Like, you know, one of the common refrains is like, well, I mean, he's playing for BBE and he should be seen by, you know, by scouts at this point, you know, but I flat out asked a pretty prominent national scout, like what his thoughts were. And he's like, I don't know, haven't seen him. And yeah. So it's like, I mean, like, I'm like, well, he's on BBE. He's like, yeah, I haven't had a chance to see BBE. So, you know, it's like, that's what kind of what we're talking about. I tend to think, and look, like even Caleb Brown, Brown, who was unranked for a long time, even he wound up being like a three-star. It was a low three-star, but it was a three-star.
Yeah.
That's what Christian Jones is going to end up being, somewhere in there. How good is he? Like, I don't, you watched him play, and I don't think Mizzou is looking at Christian Jones as a guy who's going to, you know, come in and be an all-SEC performer. You know, but he's a good developmental piece. He's a point guard with great size, good length, good vision. And he's a guy that you can develop. And if you can develop him offensively, then I think you're kind of getting into the range where you're getting a guy who can be an impact player, you know, or not like, I don't really see him impacting the team a whole lot as a freshman, just because he's coming into potentially a roster with a whole lot of seniors and a whole lot of sophomores. And a lot of those guys who we think are good. But I think the likelihood that maybe as a sophomore, provided he's patient and sticks with it, that he's a sophomore, like he's a guy who could kind of step into a reserve role and really help the team and do more so as a junior and senior.
Yeah. I went to Chicago this past weekend to watch BBE play in kind of a warm-up event for the Peach Jam and talked to Jones for about 10 minutes for a piece that hopefully I'll get to at some point. And, you know, speaking to him, he knows he's not a finished product. You know, he talked about, you know, I feel like I've got to get stronger. I feel like I can improve a little bit more on the ball defensively and holding up a little bit sometimes in pick and rolls. And, you know, he says he's working with the East St. Louis staff because he knows that he depends a little too much on his floater and he needs to get better finishing through contact. Like, he's a guy who's clearly aware that he's not showing up a finished product and that he's got to develop, and he knows where he wants to go, and Missouri sold him on a plan to help make that happen. So I think there's a self-awareness there, which is always good to hear from guys about where they've got to go and what they've got to do to get better. But like, you watch him on the floor, and I watched BBE for two games. but I've also watched, I think, 5 or 6 of East St. Louis's games. Like, you see him on the floor physically next to a guy like Nick Smith, who's a 5-star prospect in this class, top 25 prospect. Jones is a little bit longer, taller, but frame-wise does not, you know, doesn't look like a guy who's not a D1 level prospect. You know, you see him next to Kellen Thames, and he's definitely, who committed to SLU and who had a Missouri offer, a little bit longer and rangier in terms of his physical build. So he looks good on the hoof. He looks like a Division I prospect. I think the difference with him is, and we kind of mentioned it in the piece that we wrote on him after he committed, he's more of a glider than, you know, a quick twitch guy. So he's not going to blow by a defender off the bounce. He's going to understand how to use his dribble efficiently. He's going to understand how to kind of play in gaps and how to sort of use angles and sort of maneuver his way places on the floor. But like, you watch his decision making, the ball in his hand, his decision making was right up there in certain stretches with Nick Smith or with Jeremy Fierce, who are both guys in front of him. Athletically, he's just a little bit behind them. You know, he's not quite the same level athlete as those guys. And that's really, I think, sometimes you and I talk about it. That's not to say top 50 guys aren't unskilled and just getting by solely on, you know, raw physical ability, but it's a major differentiator in a lot of senses for those guys. I mean, if you are looking at those guys, there are elite 1% athletes in that group. But I think as you watch Jones, particularly defensively, you know, he's got good length. He understands how to use it. He is tenacious on the ball. You know, he's pretty good off the ball. BBE kind of switched up defenses between press and kind of changed some of its coverages and ball screens and stuff. But, you know, you watch him and think, you can see all the sort of projectable traits that Missouri has there. They're not going to be there in year one. He's not going to be a guy, I think, you, like you said, who you throw on the floor. But you watch him and you think there are some physical attributes. There are some natural sort of skill sets that, if you put it all together, he can be a pretty quality rotational guard for you. I know that's probably not what some segments of the fan base want to hear. I think they're tired of us talking about landing rotational pieces, but I think if you watch him, he's going to be a solidly rated 3-star guy, and, you know, can come in, and if he works well and if he works hard, I think he can find a place kind of as a ball handler, even if it's in a secondary role. But it's definitely not, you know, I would have argued it's not as big of a reach as we saw for a guy like a Christian Guess, who was just 100% athlete, who was, you're going to have to kind of like teach how to play basketball. This isn't a situation like that at all. This guy's got some skills. He's got some traits that I think are going to translate. It's just going to take some patience there. Again, who knows what he would have done if he had blown up this July, gone to Peach Jam and put together a monster performance and teams had moved in, you know, and there's still time for that to happen, or potential that it could happen. You know, I think fans would then rue Missouri not getting in there fast enough. So it's a yin and a yang. And, you know, I think you just have to understand that, you know, if he's not rated now, when he gets rated, he's probably going to be a 3-star guy. Then that's a developmental prospect, and it's going to be on the staff to make good on that. And we'll have to see how that happens.
So I guess didn't quite see that the ratings for 247 were updated. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was the composite rating that was updated. But at least Aiden Shaw got bumped up to 51.
Yep.
Good for him. Like, you and I have... I mean, so we have long been fans. There's a reason why we've spent a lot of time talking about Aiden Shaw. And it's because, like, he just has a really intriguing, you know, frame and skill set. And I mean, he's got great, you know, positional length. Like, he's tall and long. He can play that 3-4 combo. Just the kind of guy that I think fits really well on the Missouri roster. And he had not really seen his stock take off. And I think this is kind of the thing that you and I, we've talked about before, about, you know, guys kind of, you know, playing themselves out of where I think Missouri is feeling comfortable in the recruitment. And you look at, you know, for example, like Caleb Love was a guy who like blew up. And once the blue bloods start, you know, knocking, then it becomes really difficult to kind of keep that kid at home. Obviously, Missouri failed to do that. And I think that, I think Aiden Shaw was in that sort of same area for me when I was a little worried that he was going to basically play himself into some really, really good high level offers. And that, fortunately for Missouri, hasn't quite happened. So he has made a trip out to Maryland, but I don't really think I think Maryland right now is in a better place than Missouri has been. They've got a lot of Under Armour money and certainly some more recent success. They do have national championship and all that kind of stuff, which is nice to point to. But you know, you don't really, like, when you think of national powerhouses, you don't think of Maryland. And so them moving in, I don't think concerns me as much as, whether or not, you know, Kansas makes him a priority, whether or not, he like maybe feels more comfortable at a more like regional power. And I think this is, you know, why Missouri might be trending in the right way right now is 51 is kind of that scary range to me. Like if he bumps up like another, you know, 10 to 15 spots, then things might get interesting, but hopefully he kind of stays in that range and we're feeling good here in a few months.
Yeah. I think I watched him today and he, you know, sort of did what, you know, he's done at various points this summer where he only scored 5 points, only attempted 3 shots from the floor. But he was switching. He was, you know, being a good positional defender, good rotation. He's a guy who, when he helps down onto the block, has the size and length that he can sort of challenge bigs, but he's fluid enough that you can switch him 1-4, attentive off the ball, understands where to position himself pretty well. The nice thing I think I like about him most is that, you know, he doesn't press offensively. You know, he's not a guy who, if he's not getting touches on the offensive end of the floor, he's going to sort of go to sleep defensively or not be engaged there. You know, he's going to, you know, stay locked in defensively. He didn't rebound as much today. Terrace Reed was kind of being a monster today. And Mokan, I think, is in a little bit of a weird way going into this week because Sky Clark, their 5-star point guard, has an ACL injury, is out. So they are trying to sort through some ball handling stuff, and they looked a little bit rickety on offense. They had like 19 turnovers in a 32-minute game or something today. The turnover rate was not good. They shot based off this. They shot the ball pretty well today, but Bryson Warren needed 13 shots to get 13 points, and Terrace Reed had a pretty good day. I think he had 21 on 14 shots. But point being is, you know, you watch Shaw, and, you know, every time I've tuned in, there's been at least one or two games when Mokan's played where he's just comfortable being a stopper. And I think that's the thing I've always liked about him is that, you know, some guys will talk about, you know, they like defending, they like doing it. But on a loaded roster, he will embrace that role. You know, he's going to be a guy who starts for them and is going to be a switch defender. He's going to rebound hard. He's going to do what he needs to do on that end of the floor. I think it'll be interesting what happens to his stock through the next 2 weeks. And we're not going to, I think, know kind of what he's thinking because media can be there, but they can't interview these guys. So it'll be sort of weird, you know, if he has a breakout, you know, what he's thinking or how that changes his view on things. We won't know immediately. And I say that because, you know, he's been pretty consistent in telling folks that he would like to make a decision before he goes to Link Academy in August. And that means there's only about 3 or 4 weeks until that happens. He's got one other official visit left to Arkansas. So it feels like, I think I told you this earlier, it feels like you're entering the home stretch right now. And maybe Arkansas makes a late play. I know Maryland had a couple guys on its board commit elsewhere this week. Maybe do they reprioritize him and sort of push him up higher up the board So there's still some room there, but I think if you look around at other programs recruiting him, he's kind of second or third on the board for them. And that's not a knock on him, but it's just that Kansas is pursuing guys like MJ Rice or Chris Livingston, or Maryland's, you know, going after Cam Whitmore. There are guys that at those programs that may be a little bit in front of him right now. And, you know, based on, you know, reporting out there, Iowa, you know, got a visit, but doesn't seem thick in the thick of it. You know, will Oklahoma State, I've always felt like Oklahoma State might be sneaky, but they hosted MJ Rice on a visit. So just where does he fit on the boards of other teams? Because I think we feel pretty safe in saying he's at the top of Mizzou's board. And is that priority enough? Is that relationship with Zoe enough to finish it off? I think the next couple of weeks are going to be kind of indicative of where that goes, but we'll see. I think we're closer to the home stretch, and you know, I know you feel pretty good about their chances here, and I feel moderately confident that they can close this one out.
Yeah, I think you're always more reserved in these things than I am. I mean, it's we've laid out the table, and like, you know, who's in contention. You know, if he's really talking about committing in August, like, I just don't think there's a whole lot of time for a blow up to happen, particularly when there's a lot of guys still on the board. And I think the more of those higher level guys that are on the board are going to help Missouri's case. But I also think, like, you know, I think you have to kind of give Consul Martin and his coaching staff some credit. Like, they had not landed those guys, but like, Consul knows how to recruit. He has landed a lot of big time players in the past. So he knows what he's doing. He knows what it takes. He's just had a difficult time kind of overcoming, whatever perceptions. And I mean, it's one thing, like, you miss out on EJ Liddell. I think that's probably the biggest miss to me. Because it really did seem like it came down to like Missouri, Illinois, or Ohio State. And like, Ohio State is a better basketball program than Missouri is. Ohio State's a better basketball program than Illinois is. Ohio State's probably a top 15 level program. But, you know, that is a guy who everybody said when he was kind of going through the process, is like, this is a guy who is going to be a great, great college player. And he ended up being a great, great college player. You know, still is, I guess he's still enrolled at Ohio State. you know, but not, not somebody that you really fear is going to, come in and leave too soon, even though he did test the waters, after his sophomore year. I don't think there was any real risk of Ohio State not getting him for at least 3 years. So I think, like, that's why that's a miss. Like, Caleb Love, I mean, like, when something like that happens, a kid blows up, he gets interest from Duke, it's North Carolina, it's all like the blue buds are knocking on his door. Like, I get it. I get losing that battle. But, you know, to me, Aiden Shaw is the guy that Zoe needs to win this one. And I think that he's going to.
Yeah.
I also think he kind of knows that he needs to also.
Yeah. The one prospect I'm more intrigued with this sort of week, less so with Shaw, is Chandler Jackson, just because I think you and I have talked about, there's a world in which if they could land Jackson and Jones, that works. You know, I know you've probably been more in the camp of, you know, really shoring up ball handling and getting that sort of locked down. And
yeah,
but I haven't seen Jackson. You know,
you might want to have a few guys who can dribble, Matt, just a few.
Yeah, and I've seen, you know, cut-ups of Jackson in the spring, and, you know, he looks really good. Looks like his physique's really toned up. You know, he's more of, and I think we talked about this on the last pod, he's more of like a power, you know, kind of point. You know, he a little bit more sturdily built, you know, is going to, you know, put his shoulder into you. He can play through that contact. Just kind of almost like a bully driver more than anything else. And can play some bully ball, but I haven't seen him with Team Thad this spring, so I'm more intrigued to see him over the next couple of days. I think they play tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, so I'm probably going to tune in and watch that game just to get eyes on him. But I think there's an argument to be made that if they were not to land Shaw, but they were to get Jackson, that, you know, fortifying your ball handling and, you know, being able to push Anton Brookshire for more of a scoring point role into a combo role, and, you know, having Jerron Coleman kind of toggle between the combo spot and the wing might just give your backcourt a little bit more of a logical sort of setup. And I think it's always good to have two different types of point guards. I think it's nice to give yourself some flexibility there. But, you know, I've got to see more of Jackson this week before I, you know, really start to feel any particular way about his game, just because I want to see him. I think the only time I've seen him was two games from like January when he was playing with this high school team, and he looks substantially different now. So I kind of want to see that before I go, you know, too far in any direction on saying, you know, he's a clear pivot if you don't get Shaw.
Well, yeah. And I think it's clear at this point that they would like to get both of them. If you're looking at who is maybe the more like important recruit for the layout of the roster, I think it's Jackson. And I don't know that they have as quality of backups lined up behind Jackson as they do, you know, if Shaw were to pop somewhere else. But also with Shaw, like, I mean, positionally where he fits is already a fairly well-established position on the roster. So, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world roster-wise. I just think, I mean, we've talked about like the ceiling and all that kind of stuff, and I think he certainly helps the ceiling. Top 50 guy. I think he has NBA potential as a kind of a 3-and-D guy. And if you get that, then I think you're feeling a lot better. And I certainly think, like, you know, the vocal detractors of Zoe and his recruiting so far are feeling a lot better. If you're coming out of a class with Shaw and Jackson and Jones, I think like that's a dream scenario right now if you're Missouri. Unless Isaac Trout's still on the radar, Matt. I know he's one of your favorites. And did you see Hollander? Hollander was watching him. He's still fighting the battle. I mean,
I watched Nick Smith play this weekend. It doesn't mean that I think, you know, he's in line for Missouri. You know, I think I wish that they would look at Jason Green off of Isaac Trout's team. I really like that kid. I would encourage people, if you really want to get wonky, to go look up Jason, Jasen Green. Missouri called him last year when he was still with MOCAN last June, but he kind of went to a home state program in Nebraska Supreme, and he's a really intriguing prospect. Like, just, he's already physically mature, but he's 6'6". You can play him as like a small ball 4 and 5. Like, he can post. He's got a pretty competent handle. He can space. He can pick and pop. Or you can just play him as a straight wing. He's just got all kinds of positional flexibility. His recruitment is probably further along than necessary for Missouri to get involved, but I was always kind of hoping they would take a look at Green, because I thought he was sort of an interesting sort of multidimensional fit for them if they wanted to get involved there. But Missouri never really dove headlong into that. So maybe Hollander was watching Jason Green and was like, hey, this guy's pretty good.
I mean, yeah, so Hollander was at the game where Trout was. And I think, you know, these recruiting analysts are like, hey, like, Isaac Trout's playing, and here are the coaches in attendance. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the coach is watching that player. I think Trout already released a list and Missouri was.
He's already taken
it.
5 visits, and Missouri was not one of the stops. We can talk about, too, the board clearing out a little bit. Missouri went on that run of offering BBE guys in late June, and, well, within 2 weeks, they'd all picked their spots. Connor Turnbull, a guy I really liked, held off a commitment to Butler for a long time. Let Missouri.
I like that fit a lot, actually. You know, like, I think it could have worked for him at Missouri. I really do. Like, I think it could have worked.
He's perfect within the Butler system. He's a pitch perfect 5 for them.
And I think the Big East is a better fit for him overall skill wise. Like, you know, the SEC is an athletic league. And I'm not saying Turnbull isn't a good athlete. I think he is actually a solid athlete.
Watching him live, he's not stiff. He no. moves pretty well, and he just doesn't have freakish hops, but he's not slow off the floor. 2 feet off the floor, he's pretty good. He's really fluid. I watched him screen and sort of operate moving around the perimeter. He is comfortable in space, which is perfect for what Butler's going to do with him as a pick and pop guy. They're going to want to space him to the corner at times. You know, he's going to be able to get post touches and operate in the mid post a little bit.
He's going to fit jumpers for days.
He's going to be perfect for them. But you know, seeing him up close, he's going to be a really great fit for them. But Missouri and SLU got in there, but Butler had been on him for a while. And no surprise he popped there. One of Butler's assistants was in Chicago, just checking up on him, just watching. So I think that's a really nice fit. And then Kellen Thames, I believe late last week, what was it, Thursday or Friday, that he committed to SLU, which you'd watched more of him on film than I had. I got to watch him this weekend, and sneakier athleticism than I thought. You know, if he gets a step and goes off 2 feet, he can finish and he can put one on your head. He did a couple of times this weekend. He's got some sneaky bounce to him. I think he's more of a straight combo to a wing than a point. This weekend, he didn't really run the point at all. He played off the ball a lot, but I think he's a guy who's going to fit well at SLU. I think he's a solidly three-star guy. I think Missouri could have found a way to fit him in, but if they were looking for more of a straight point, I get why they took Jones. And again, that's not a knock on Kellen Thames. I'm sure if any SLU fans heard this, they would say it's a Missouri guy trying to explain away why the kid picked SLU or trying to downplay it. No, if there are any SLU fans listening, you got a really great prospect. He's going to be a really good fit for what Travis Ward wants to do. I think that just positionally, Missouri probably needed to go more towards a point than a combo in that sort of setup. But I think he looks like he's going to be clearly comfortable in the Atlantic 10.
I think he's going to be a really good college player. I think the ceiling on Jones is probably higher. I really like Thames.
You can see that he can fit.
Yeah, he's a smart, heady guy.
Yeah.
You could tell, like, his dad played. It's just one of those things, like, you always know when you kind of watch kids, like, if they grew up around the game, that there's just, like, intuition on certain things, you know, particularly defense and how they, you know, work at spacing the floor, how they look spacing the floor, you know, how they're able to kind of, you know, manipulate and control defenders. It's just one of those things that, like, you learn by being around it. And you can tell, like, I'm happy that he's staying close, you know, because I do watch not a lot of SLU games, but I do watch them. So I'm looking forward to watching him kind of develop, and I think that'll be fun. Yeah. And it'll certainly be fun for, like, the SLU Mizzou discourse to sort of watch, you know, Jones and Thames. I just think Thames is probably more of a sure thing as far as, like, you know, being a good college player. And I think Jones is more like the, you know, the bet that he can kind of figure it out. And, you know, he has the body, he has the, you know, the skills. He just got to kind of put it all together offensively.
Yeah. And I'll be interested in a couple of weeks. The Under Armour circuit will be passing through Indy, so I'll be able to get eyes back on Yander's Law, and who will have Jonathan Dunn, who has a Missouri offer coming through. I'll be interested to see how he looks. More of a traditional kind of, like, four. I just watched him the last time they came through for an event, man. I watched them play five games. He's more of a roller, you know, rim runner type of guy. He can post, but I think he's going to need some work with Chris Hollander on the block if he's going to play in that spot. But the shooting mechanics have come along, so I'm really intrigued to see how he looks in about 2 weeks when they come through Indy. So that'll be sort of a good check-in for guys that right now seem like they're kind of plan B prospects on the board for Missouri right now. So that's kind of the state of play here. I think we're going to get through July. Peach Jam wraps up, not this weekend, but next weekend. And there's a break, and then we get into August. And that's about the time you start seeing lists cut and guys start committing. So we're getting into the where rubber meets road, to borrow a cliche, with some of these guys. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how the board finally shakes out as we move into the fall.
Yeah, and I mean, I really don't think, if Missouri is able to, land Shaw at some point in August, it looks like Jackson's timeline is a little longer. I think they'll be more than willing to kind of sit in on that one. But it'll certainly be interesting to see, if they do sort of get their guy with Shaw, what happens if they maybe fall in love with somebody else at the point guard spot, during Peach Jam or the following, following weeks in the AAU circuit and all that. So there's definitely, like, we're definitely getting to the point in the summer where a lot of things start to kind of shake loose. I think Missouri has their board pretty solid right now. If either of those two guys want to commit, they'll probably just sew it up and call it a day for the 2022 class. But I do think there's some potential for us to maybe, see a couple more offers go out, once they actually get their eyes on guys at Peach Jam.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how many more they throw out. There are about 26 or 27 offers. Missouri under Martin has never really blown past 30. And I can't, they've thrown out some, late in the summer. If there's a guy who absolutely, I think of like a Jericho Helms, his Zoe's first year, who just blew up at Peach Jam and they got in. But he still had time to commit. So it'll be interesting how much time is left for some of these guys. I think the reason why you saw, even a guy like Turnbull or Thames commit is you get into a spot where do you want to risk it in July hunting for more offers when you've got a slot available and you're happy? Do you just take it and commit if you like your spot, or do you weigh it out and see if you can earn bigger offers? So I think sometimes you see guys commit before they go out in July just because, they would rather take the bird in the hand and they feel comfortable with what they have, and they just decide that they want to end the recruitment there and just focus on July and go into their senior year with that off their back. So I think we saw a little bit of that a couple of weeks ago, but Jackson and Shaw, as you said, are probably going to take this out a little bit longer. Shaw probably, wrapping up sooner than Jackson.
Yeah. Is there anything that we need to kind of go into on the financial impact of budgets on recruiting? I do kind of want to tease a little bit because, you did a lot of legwork to go in and figure out a lot on staff pay. And I don't necessarily think we need to, I guess pre-write what you're planning on publishing here, but it's certainly like I feel like the two pieces that I wrote were at least providing a little bit of a table setting for the meat of the work, which you did, and talking about like why we actually think Missouri needs more investment into basketball.
I'll try and be pretty succinct here. Like, there are three relationships that I've always, that, most of us intuitively, think, impact success. How much does a program spend on basketball? Does that expenditure allow them to have the resources to bring in talent that will improve on-court performance? So it's not like it's not a causation thing. If you look at the relationships between what programs spend over time, the quality of recruit they land over time and their on-court performance over time, you see pretty strong correlations, given other variables are in play, and, we can go down a statistical, rabbit hole explaining it, but the metrics that sort of like at a top level for correlating those things are pretty strong. So we can say that there's a relationship between what a program spends and the quality of recruit it brings in and its on-court success. For Missouri, since it moved to the SEC, it's typically been between like 39th and 67th among high majors in spending in its total hoop expenses. If you look at how that, you know, correlates out, Missouri should be landing a kid that's like around 0.90 it correlates to around a 0.90 recruit rating. That's about what Missouri's done since moving to the SEC. If you were to like look at like the line of best fit and where its spending overlaps with or lines up with that line of best fit for average wins, it's about 18 or 19 wins. So like if you were to look at Missouri's budget since moving to the SEC, you'd expect them to land a kid that's like around 160 or 170 in the composite and for Missouri to win 18 or 19 games a year. Like that's not like a projection. That's just kind of looking at where things kind of land with the line of best fit and with correlations and stuff. That's about what Missouri's done, withstanding, you know, the Kim Anderson debacle. And so when I talk about like why I don't get upset about Missouri's performances is because if you were to like look at the baseline indicators for the kind of talent it should get and for the kind of on-court performance we should have, at least under Konzo Martin, when there hasn't been injuries, that's been what it is. The question is, if you're going to, you know, ramp up the budget, where does that happen? Recruiting budgets can be a little bit weird just because, like, if you're a staff jetting all over the country and flying private and, like, your hotel accommodation, like, you can spend a lot of money if you're recruiting nationally or if, like, you're pretty good at, like, working your local recruiting ground. Like, if you're Purdue and you're really good at recruiting Indiana, you can keep your budget down a little bit. You know, you can go find two or three in-state guys and, you know, you can work into Ohio or Michigan. You're not going to run up like a huge, you know, recruiting bill. A lot of it is going to be head coach pay and staff pay. And if you look at Missouri staff pay, the records across the SEC are kind of incomplete and FOIA rules are different for every state a little bit, but Missouri, at least in the last couple of years, has been towards the lower end of staff pay in the SEC. Like, I'd probably say they're between, like, 10th and 13th. I need to go back and pull other records for that, but I feel pretty safe in saying they're somewhere around there. So, if you're looking
I think, so if I can kind of hop in and interrupt, like, yeah. I think one of the things that boosted that was when they did sort of make the Porter play.
Yeah.
Did not pay off as we all would have liked it to. But there was an investment there. And it, like, I don't want to be seen as like constantly going after the admin for not spending when without pointing out when they do.
That's
like,
fair.
Like the locker room upgrades and the things that they have needed to do for several years and they're doing now. Like, that's good.
That gets me to the point, though. Relative to its peers, Missouri's spending has not moved. Like, so Missouri's year-over-year spending is higher than it was back when it moved to the SEC. It spends $3 million more now than it did when it moved to the SEC. Its ranking among high majors, though, has not moved. Like, it's still in the 40s and 50s, which tells you that relative to its peers, it is not, like, passing anyone. It's basically doing a COLA adjustment on spending. And yes, there are some outlays like locker room upgrades or, you know, the Porter contract that are in there. But, like, overall, if you were to look at just total expenses and the accounting for that, Missouri's about in the same place it was when it moved into the SEC. So I always tend to think, like, if you're going to look at where Missouri is going to invest, is it, you know, in staff pay? You know, if Konzo wanted to, you know, make changes or go out and add someone, would he have the budget to do it? You know, that's something that would have to be reported out by the folks in Columbia, but that's sort of always been my point, which is if you just though look at from a very high level, Missouri's investment basically is that of a program that's towards the lower middle class of high majors, and the results have backed that up. And if you're frustrated by that, you're by all rights, you can be. I just think sometimes it's a little bit of a fool's errand to get upset that your program that's 50th in spending is not performing at a top 25 level. Like Gonzaga has passed Missouri in spending. Creighton has passed Missouri in spending. For a while, Wichita State and Houston and other AAC programs were comparable to Missouri in spending. And so if you're going to complain about Missouri's on-court performance, I think you have to understand, or at least have the context to where you know that there are other programs out there that are ramping up investment. You know, we talked about Houston. Houston's budget now is, I think, north of $8 million. They opened a $30 million practice facility. They've renovated their on-campus arena. Like, they are competing like a high major. They are in the AAC, which has, you know, some shallower depth, but they're competing at that level. They're spending at that level. Cincinnati, another AAC program, is, you know, renovated its arena. It's, you know, paying, you know, substantially, you know, higher salaries as well. There are programs out, you know, you look at Memphis, another AAC program. They've hired Penny Hardaway. There are programs out there that, even if they're not in a Power Five conference, maybe are a little bit more committed budgetarily to the sport. And so I think it's just, you, once you look around at Missouri's peers and you sort of understand that from a financial perspective, Missouri's not even in the upper half of its, you know, cohort of conference, of power conference teams, it's just hard for me to be upset that they're not consistently in the top 25, because, you know, broadly speaking, the dollars would tell you that there's a correlation between spending and winning. And Missouri is spending like a team where 18, 19, 20 wins is the baseline. And, you know, what can they do to move that outside of hoping that Konzo Martin overachieves? So that's just sort of the relationship and sort of what I've been working on. And hopefully after we do the SEC roster review, I'll be able to finally write that piece.
Yeah, and I certainly like, I think it's an interesting exercise because very clearly Missouri doesn't have the financial wherewithal of some other athletic departments. They don't have the donor base that like Alabama or Georgia, who have, like, you know, football programs that basically spend what Missouri's entire athletics program spends. You know, not to a T, but close. And it's difficult to, you know, compete with that level of an uneven playing field in football. And so that's like you kind of mentioned, is it a fool's errand a little bit to invest as much as Missouri has to, you know, and into football? And I would make an argument that I don't necessarily think it's a fool's errand, as long as you keep your expectations within within reason. Like, are you trying to move? Are you expecting to move ahead of like those top six programs in the SEC? Are you just trying to move ahead of the middle of the pack? Like, are you trying to get ahead of Kentucky? Because I think you can get, yeah, like, I think you can reasonably expect to get ahead of those teams. And then, you know, you have one of those years where the timing is right and you can sort of take advantage of, you know, the stars aligning a little bit and make a championship game or make a playoff, or if they expand the playoffs, be in the playoffs with a little bit more regularity. But basketball is different, you know, because there's, the example that I sort of threw out a little bit was Illinois. Like, Illinois has made a very big financial commitment to basketball. And Illinois is a regional rival. So here is a team who was willing to give an assistant coach $1 million to get players. That's basically what Orlando Antigua is. I mean, he's an average basketball coach. He's a player getter. And he has gotten Illinois players. And John Calipari liked it when Orlando Antigua was getting him players. So he offered him and Chin Coleman to move to Kentucky and to get him players instead of Brad Underwood. And Illinois put that cash on the table. And is there any scenario where you can see Missouri making the same play?
No.
Right. Like, and I think that, to me, like, that is what I mean when I talk about commitment. Are you willing to do what it takes And like Missouri had a phenomenal softball season, and Tennessee came in and poached their top two assistants. They went on to make more money at Tennessee. I realize softball is not the same kind of, you know, financial windfall that, that basketball and football can be, you know, but that still shows that, you know, that Missouri is always, it will always be, or at least is always okay being a program that does a little bit more with less. And that's their expectation, is that expectation of the athletics program is to do with what we have, and to exceed expectations. And that's just really difficult to do.
Like, you look at Arkansas, I think Arkansas last year paid over $850,000 in staff pay. I think if you looked at what Missouri was closer to like $610,000 or something. Like, to the difference is really they paid more money to have David Patrick on their staff. And then Oklahoma came in and gave David Patrick $100,000 more, and he makes $500,000 at Oklahoma. Oklahoma, a former Big Eight regional rival, I think has a staff budget of $900,000. So if you look at Missouri and say, okay, Missouri's $200,000-$400,000 below other programs in terms of assistant pay, that's what I'm talking about in terms of investment is, you know, it's not so much is Missouri like spending more money for its coaches flying around. Is it, are they paying guys who, and are they giving Zoe the resources if he wanted to go out and make massive, you know, upgrades to his staff? Could he do it? And if you look historically at Missouri staff pay over the last 5, 6, 7 years, they've never come close to broaching like $800,000. And, you know, again, the market changes and certain guys want to work at certain places for certain reasons. Like, money isn't the cure all there, but, or I think at Illinois, the cheapest coach they had was $325,000 was their lowest paid coach. I think Marco Harris made $130,000 last year at Missouri. So it's, again, I don't want to say like it's a uniform thing across the market, but I just think you look inside and you do kind of that cursory look at the books and you start to see, well, yeah, now I know why some programs are, you know, outperforming us. They're spending more in certain areas where, you know, it shows up on the floor. And I don't think we've ever advocated for Missouri just to throw around $12 million, to throw around $12 million. I think you can still be strategic with your investments. Like, you can be strategic with your coaching and your salary pool for staff. You can, or your support staff, whether it's strength and conditioning, whether it's, you know, nutrition, whether it's any of those sort of areas that sort of deal with the player experience. Can you invest strategically there? You know, Missouri's doing some upgrades in the locker room and player, you know, sort of common areas. That's a fine $1.4 million investment. That's smart. That's good money. You know, I don't think you have to like say we're going to like triple or we're going to like take our budget up 25-30%. I think what you and I have talked about is, are there strategic ways you can infuse some more money into the budget to, you know, really target areas that are going to show up on the floor? And I think that's what I would have always advocated for, is I just don't think you need to throw money around. I think you can be smart about where you want to put it and you can be strategic. So that's, I think that's what I would hope people will take away from when I eventually get around to writing this thing is, you know, it's not just a blank check. It's just taking a strategic look at where can we close gaps or where can we, you know, be, you know, pretty thoughtful about putting dollars.
Yeah. And I'd also like to make my final point was there was a guy on Twitter who was sort of, you know, talking about how Missouri has invested and, you know, because, and his, one of his examples was, you know, because they made Konzo Martin the highest paid coach in school history. And it's like you were saying earlier, like that's great. And he is exactly making more than every coach in Missouri school history. But you know what? Like, so is every other Power Five conference coach right now. You can pretty much go up and down the board, and the guy who is sitting in that seat is making more than anybody else in history. Now, there'll be some exceptions if, you know, like I'm sure who's the head coach at Travis Steele, right? At Xavier. Yeah. So he's probably making less than what Chris Mack was playing. But Chris Mack, like, had Xavier in
on the doorstep of a Final Four.
Yeah, they were a one seed. I think when you sort of put things in that sort that level of perspective, yes, Missouri is spending more than they have in the past.
But again, that goes back to my point. They're still in the 40s and 50s overall in expenses.
Exactly. They've increased, and so has everybody else. And if you're okay, like, you know, being a similar program to Ole Miss, then that's what Missouri is at this point.
Ole Miss has more staff pay.
Well, I was going to say, like, with a little better historical.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's it. Like, that's the difference. I mean, Ole Miss has a new facility that's, like, freaking awesome. You know, like, Kermit Davis makes slightly less than Consuelo Martin, but not much. That's the reality of college sports now. So I would like Missouri to spend more. Matt, I would like them to spend it more strategically. So, you know, we're just not throwing money around, but I would like them to spend more because I would like for Missouri to be really good at basketball. I find it's more fun to write about really good teams.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, I'll still do wonky crap about teams that lose a lot.
Hey, I wrote through the Kim Anderson years.
I'm not going to get hazard pay the way you did. So, that's true, but. No, hopefully, the last thing I would say is, and I feel like some people would think that I'm being an apologist or that I'm making excuses. You can feel free to want Missouri to be better. I think that's a good thing that, you know, fans look at the program and they have passion and they want, you know, Missouri to be relevant. They want to feel like the thing they invest their time and their emotional energy in returns something back to them. I just think it's hard for me, and I'm a broken record on this. It's hard for me to get upset about a program's performance when I know that it's basically operating at the level that its resources would indicate or would be commensurate with. And I just find it's hard for me to get upset at, like, Zoe and with recruiting and everything when, you know, essentially that ire can be summed up as we want the coach we hired to overachieve. Now, that may get some people upset and say, how dare you say that he's making $3 million a year? That's fine again. But what you're asking is for a program that's, you know, been 10th or 11th in the SEC in spending, 10th or 11th in recruiting, 10th or 11th in attendance to push for top six, top five, top four. You're asking for it to overachieve. And is that a reasonable expectation? Is my expectation that, you know, they're going to win 18, 19, that at this level, the way they're operating, they're going to, you know, get into the tournament two out of every 4 years. And, you know, maybe the right core comes along and they go on a big run. Is my expectation, you know, really setting a low bar, or is it just realistic for what it is? And is someone, you know, saying, you know, I want this program to be in the top 25 consistently, and I wish, you know, we were landing top 50, top 75 guys with more regularity. Is that reasonable given everything we've talked about? And, you know, I'm not going to tell you not to feel that way. I just think that that sets up disappointment that kind of is unnecessary. And, you know, it's on Missouri and it's on, you know, Jim Sterk and it's on Martin to sort of disprove that or sort of, you know, show that, you know, their plan is going to result in a program that meets hopes and expectations for the people who pay money and who donate to the, and give them their time. So I think that's my only thing. It's just, I would hope that people over time can start to kind of calibrate expectations in a way that's reasonable for where the program is right now.
Great. So be on the lookout for Matt's very uplifting piece on how Missouri doesn't spend money. but it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't land guys like Aiden Starr, Chandler Jackson, who I think we both think could really help boost Missouri's profile.
Oh, breaking. Guess who just came across the wire? Guess who got an offer?
Who got an offer?
Jason Green.
Oh, oh, that's fantastic. So Hollander was totally watching Jason Green.
I'm sorry. I mean, sometimes my eyes are okay, I guess. I mean, oh man, I love that offer. That's a great offer. I would encourage people to go look up his highlights. He's a fantastic kind of like hybrid wing.
He does a lot of things well. Like I would call him like a winning basketball player. He's not like a standout guy, but he is a winning basketball player.
That he is. But I just thought you'd like to know that my foresight was actually documented live for our listeners.
So we're going to wrap this up. My birthday is tomorrow. Matt, I turn 29. that is not true at all, but so we are recording Tuesday, July 13th. We will be back in 2 weeks. I believe BK and Nate will be back again. I don't know if you checked out their latest pod, but Nate interviewed a couple lawyers on the NIL stuff, and it was really fascinating. So I encourage everybody to check it out. If you're like, I don't really care about this this football stuff, I'm only into basketball, go back into your feed and listen to that podcast, because it's really informative on how the law side of the NIL stuff works. It's really, really fascinating. So great job, Nate, on that. You and I will be back in a couple weeks, and we can talk about Jason Green. So until then, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Enjoy your mid-July doldrums of college sports. Hopefully Eli and Zo can knock a few more recruits in the bag. We can actually have some news on this. But until 2 weeks from now, thanks for tuning in.